Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is MacBreak Weekly, episode 82 for March 26th, 2008. The Double Album. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/MacBreak. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. Let us begin this show. Whatever it might be, whatever it may turn out to be. This is Mac Break Weekly with the largest cast ever assembled. A cast so big, we had to fill a stadium. Starting, I'm going to do this in Skype order, which means totally randomly. Andy Inatko from the Chicago Sun-Times, or Tun-Times, or Fun-Times.
And the unfortunately, the guy who was supposed to register the Sun-Times domain let it lapse, so we had to like register something similar. So update your bookmarks. It's now tuntimes.com. I think suntimes.com goes to some sort of like organic nut and berry farm.
He's joking, kids. I should just warn everybody, as we probably should have done last week before the FSKCY incident, that anything you hear on this show, you should not do. You should not believe. It is all a hoax. Merlin Mann, Mr. FSCK-FY. Hello, Merlin Mann.
Hi, Leo. I got a note from a friend who said that we literally turned his Mac into, he said, a bologna. FSCK, and now he has a large piece of deli meat.
My bologna has a first name. It's FSCKY. Thank you, Merlin. Merlin's at 43folders.com. Also here, Scott Bourne from The Bourne Ultimatum, The Bourne Supremacy, but more importantly, Podango, GirlsGoneGeek.tv, and the ApplePhoneShow.com. Hello, Scott Bourne.
I am so excited. A show all about Geezer. Finally, I get to shine.
No. Weezer.
Weezer?
Weezer.
Who's Weezer? Is Weezer? I thought it was all about Geezers, old guys. I thought it was time for me to really get to shine the show.
Never. What's all this about Geezers?
Alex Lindsay. Alex Lindsay's also here from the Pixel Corps, but I want... Hello, Alex.
Hello.
Oh, see, now your T1 sounds great.
Oh, does it?
You wired it.
Yeah, exactly.
You plug it in. But our biggest, most exciting person here on the panel, I am so thrilled to welcome the drummer from Weezer, Mr. Patrick Wilson. Patrick, hello, welcome.
Thank you very much. How's everyone?
Doesn't he sound warm? It's that
That's proximity effect on the mic here.
And the tube amp.
Yep.
You're actually going through a tube amp?
I'm actually going through a vintage channel strip. Out of a quad 8 console with transformers, so that's why it's so smooth.
Wow.
That's why you sound like Howlin' Wolf. It's nice. It's got a real warm quality.
I think we should get that for all of our panelists.
As a matter of fact, we're also going from vinyl today. There's going to be no downloads of this episode. We want that nice, warmer, more analog sound.
So. And a little later
talk about it. I just bought a 4-track.
4-track, really?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I have like a new old stock Marantz 4-track set.
A little later on, we're going to turn on the tweeter horns and get that really extra special vibrato in the show. So it's going to be great.
Yeah, it's good.
The rotating tweeter horns, they're really going to make it.
We're going to take an ad in the back pages of Cream.
Leslie, that's
just,
it.
Just the perfect vintage feel.
Patrick, so it's good to have you. I understand you're a recent convert to the Macintosh.
That's true. I was into Windows boxes for a long time. Actually, I'm not even sure I was into them. I just used them.
Yeah, nobody's into Windows. Just what you got.
Yeah, and after a while, all my friends started crossing over, and I was like, well, I'm going. But everyone else in Weezer uses Windows, and
really?
They make fun of me. Yeah, they still make fun of me.
I don't know why. I just assume that anybody who's making music is using Macs.
I thought so, too.
But not so, apparently.
Well, you can do a lot of cool stuff with Windows these days if you got the right hardware.
What software were you using?
I was using Samplitude, which I think actually might even be a little bit superior to Logic, but I'm using Logic right now.
The new Logic you're not as happy with is Samplitude?
Well, I'm just used to Samplitude, but I'm you know what? It's like all German and Windows is
from Magix.
You know what I mean? Like Macintoshes are so cool. Like everything fades out and fades in, and the user interface is like, it's really pretty. And then Windows is like, you know, you tell it to do something, it goes, and then it does it. And like, I don't know.
It's an engineering design. If it is either on or off, it's binary. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. It's a work, so it doesn't work. None of this fading is very stupid. Merlin was very excited about it. Actually, Andy wrote us a whole scenario. We really blew this because we could, you know, we could have done this whole scenario about you showing up on the show. And Andy had, you had three or four.
Well, I just think we missed an opportunity. We could have done the one where, like, Merlin brags to everybody about he totally knows you and he can totally get you to the show, and we all kind of doubt him. And he has to, like, sneak into, like, the hotel where you guys are going to be as disguised as Middle Eastern royalty just so we can get close enough to invite you to the show. And then turns out that you knew about it all along. You came in just to make sure he would save face. We had the one where I'm like sort of the geeky tech guy in the band, and I only play the ukulele, and you guys won't let me play. I'm only part of the band because my uncle has this cool van to pick stuff in, and there's a battle of the bands, and there's this snooty yacht club guy who wants to win the battle of the bands, and finally it turns out that the uncle with the van is actually my friend Patrick from Weezer, who comes in and, like, you know, joins me on ukulele and saves the day, and we win the battle. There are a whole bunch of things we could have done to just really, there's sort of a user interface to bringing in an extra special, like, celebrity musician on an ongoing show that simply saying, hey, everybody, we're having a special musical celebrity guest on the show next week. That's just a blown opportunity.
I know. I kind of screwed it up.
What's happening, gang? Help the Doobie Brothers catch the guys who are bootlegging their concert.
That's good.
I would have liked that one. Like, we get out there and find the tapers in the audience.
And then what? How does this work in the Weezer?
I guess they play Taking It to the Streets.
Okay.
Alex, I'm Patrick of Weezer. I'm in a band, and I have to tell you, you don't have to do drugs to be a cool member of the music community. As a matter of fact, you know, see that sort of thing.
Well, it's true that there's a real reason we like to have people who are actually working musicians, signed artists on the show, because we just basically blow smoke about the music industry and how it's changing and what it means for artists. But it's nice to have somebody who's actually got, you know, a dog in this hunt to come on once in a while and set us straight. Do you, your stuff is obviously it's on iTunes, right?
That's right.
And probably on Amazon as well, in unprotected form, yeah?
I think so.
Who's your label?
Geffen, which is under Universal.
I think Universal does not offer unprotected on iTunes, but does on Amazon.
Okay.
How do you feel about, do you care about DRM? Is that an issue that comes up for you?
I think it sucks. I mean, what are you gonna, it's like, you know, it's a pain in the ass for everybody. And I'm sure my label will hate me saying that, but I don't know. I feel like if you buy something, you should just be able to do whatever you want with it.
All the albums, Weezer, Pinkerton, Make Believe, all available on Amazon, unprotected. For 10 cents less.
I think that's great. What are they, $2.56?
The albums are $8.90 and the cuts are 89 cents.
Oh, I just meant the bit rate.
Yeah, $2.56. I'm sorry. I thought you meant dollars. No, yeah, 256 kilobits.
I think it makes a difference.
Yeah. I mean, I would think you would like that, actually.
Hey, Patrick, have you been watching what Trent Reznor's been doing?
I have been watching, and I think it's great. I honestly really want all bands to be able to have more of a one-to-one relationship with their audience. I think it's wonderful.
Just to recap, after... Radiohead put its album up, you know, kind of, you name your price, Trent, and released his stuff under Creative Commons, which I think was spectacular. And he's, what, they made $1.6 million in the first 10 days?
Yeah. $750,000, I think, just from the $300 version or $150 version of the album. That I think it was $150 version of it that came with all the signed stuff or whatever, but there was only 2,500 copies and they sold it out immediately.
So that's smart.
Yeah.
I heard him kind of shredding Radiohead for, like, not being on the up and up. Did you guys see that?
No. What did he say?
He's like, well, they're not really being on the up and up. Like, you, I don't know. He was just kind of complaining about how he's more OG than they are.
because they did a CD as well.
I think because you can't download from the Rainbow's site anymore, can you?
Now that the CD's out, maybe they pulled it back. Maybe so. What is he saying? It's essentially a publicity ploy on their part, and he's committed.
Well, it's interesting because I started thinking about this. We'll be out of our contract after the next record, and I'm like, man, is anyone going to care? Like, is it going to seem so played out that, oh yeah, here's our record, go give us whatever you like for it, or is it still going to be exciting? You know, maybe he's feeling a little bit of that, like, well, hold on, I'm doing something actually cooler than Radiohead,
right? But he was number two.
Yeah, or it's just like a kind of a getting past the novel aspect of the free price.
So would you be able to convince the rest of the band to leave the label and go it on your own?
I'm not asking
because I don't want to put you in a difficult position with Geffen. I'm not asking you if that's your plan. I'm just saying what their reaction would be to something like that.
I don't know, because I'm like the guy who's always coming up with the harebrained schemes, like, hey, let's do this. So,
well, there he goes again.
Probably if I suggest it, that almost guarantees it won't happen. But I think we'll have a million options in front of us once that time comes. But I have to say, like, there's a reason that record companies were around in the first place. It's because, you know, they work as sort of like, ideally is an aggregator, like, hey, we know what's smart, right? Or we know what's good, here, check it out, we believe in this. I mean, obviously that balance has been kind of shredded because, you know, as time goes on, their the quality is more like a lowest common denominator, in my opinion.
Well, and so when, like, you started, I mean, even in the 90s, when you started, it still was so expensive to make a record. You could use that four track, but you couldn't really do a bang up job by yourself, right?
Well, here's the irony. That record, the blue record, which to this day sells more than the other records every week, costs $120,000 to make.
Huh.
Is that including Ocasix?
Yeah, Rick Ocasix was, he was with us on that. Now, every single record we've made after that has cost like exponentially greater.
Right.
Like, we probably just dropped $1 million making a record.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm like, come on, guys, let's get back to basics here. Like, my idea is, let's go live to two track. Let's just let's plug everything into the console.
Hey, that was state of the art back in my day.
Dude, I mean, listen to Kind of Blue. Listen to right. Take Five. I mean, right. Those records are amazing.
Listen to Hound Dog. I mean, Hound Dog was 42 takes or whatever, but man, you can't get any better sound than that.
Well, here's news for you, though. Nevermind by Nirvana. You think, I mean, Butch Vig made him do Smells Like Teen Spirit like 60 times.
Wow.
And that's with all the technology.
Wow.
So you still
punches,
have to do it.
You don't have to do punches as much, though, right? As a drummer, you don't have to.
You start. You lead off.
Yeah, right.
Well, what we try and do is get like what I kind of call like the pure take, which is us interacting.
Oh, that's nice.
And then with the idea of keeping the drums, and then if anything else is magic, they'll keep it, but mostly you'll just go back and fix mistakes. On my end, I like to keep it so that the drums are the bedrock, and I don't really go back and fix anything.
I think that's,
you know what, when you start opening up a Pro Tools session, you start moving kicks and snares around, suddenly just cut it to the grid, you know, make dance music out of it, because you can't. Seriously, it just turns into, you know, Nickelback or something. I don't know. And props to Nickelback for being, you know, gazillionaires and being, you know, successful. But I don't want our records to sound like that.
Patrick, how do you feel about stuff like your songs appearing in GarageBand? I mean, in Rock Band.
Yeah, I think it's great.
That's where I have to confess, I'm not as musically hip as most people. I'm still listening to the latest, Three Dog Night record. But I found your music there and really enjoyed it. And I wonder how many people like me, you know, get exposed to you through something like a video game, which has been selling like hotcakes. And how does the record company play into those kinds of deals? Because those are the kind of licensing deals that a lot of musicians wouldn't have the business ability to negotiate. I'm just curious what you think about all that.
Well, I think in general, video game people kind of look at what they do as doing you a favor in some ways. Oh. Like, hey, you know, if you want to get a song into a video game, it's just like a soundtrack. There's not a ton of money in it for the bands, but I think it's invaluable because that's what kids do, man. I play games. I mean, that's one of the main reasons why CD sales are down, because, I mean, sure, there's all kinds of other reasons, but people got things to do, and one of them is play video games.
Right, right.
Well, I was amazed. My brother makes me these, you know, mix CDs, and I can't, you know, I was like, where do you ever hear this on the radio? And he doesn't hear any of it on the radio. He hears it on skiing videos.
Oh, interesting.
And totally. So he finds the music from those things, and then he listens to those, and then he takes the best of that and sends us mixed stuff, and it's really fresh, and it's stuff that you've never, you know, that I would have never heard. I would have never found any other way than him, you know, putting it in front of us, you know.
I love it. I think it's great. Any way that you can reach people and turn them on to music is great.
Now, do you make a lot of money with your live performances?
We make the majority of our pie comes from merchandise and performances. I mean, I'm sure you guys have discussed ad nauseum how, you know, like the typical band deal for a label is not very equitable.
Well, has that brought up the question of why don't we release some singles or some songs for free just strictly because it builds up to make more money with through those avenues and basically indirect income from the music?
It's interesting because two records ago, we basically sort of wrote the record with fans. We were mad at the label and we were like, all right, F them. We're going to work with fans directly, almost like a giant focus group. And in some ways that was really interesting, but in other ways, I think it removes the layer of mystery that I think is for us more important than pure transparency. You know, like you think of Led Zeppelin and those guys never did interviews. They never did anything. You never even saw pictures of them. So for us, that's kind of like where we're heading on it.
Mm. You're going into hiding?
Not really. We're just trying to find a balance, you know, like, who cares if, oh, you know, what if I was on Twitter, dude? I don't even know what Twitter is, but I know that you guys are into it. And it's like, what is it? Like, I'm going to the bathroom. Oh, I'm, you know what? I love it because Dvorak is always harshing on Twitter. That guy rules.
I thought on the last tweet I got him on there, but I see he hasn't signed up. So he was obviously just, you know.
That's a common misconception, Pat. The thing is, once you're on the can, that's when the Twittering gets really good.
That's when it gets exciting.
That's where you build a fan base.
That's where actually Merlin does all his Twittering from.
It's true. I'm pretty upfront about that.
Yeah. Am I missing an opportunity here?
Yeah, like, you are.
Can I just say, Pat, you're leaving money on the table. Money on the table.
Now, I think actually the first person who gets on Twitter, first actual celebrity as opposed to faux celebrities, will get a lot of attention, especially if you, instead of Twittering things like I'm having a hamburger right now, actually talk about your process. I think that's what it is. It's a mini blog. It's a micro blog.
A micro blog.
Yeah. Which makes it easy because you only get 140 characters. So it's not like you have to sit down and write something, but you can say,
like, I could be at the DMV and be like, wow, the DMV is really slow. This stinks later.
Awesome.
You could.
Or you could discuss the new Zildjian symbols you're thinking of purchasing.
That would be interesting, right?
Yeah.
Or why you would prefer Zildjian over some other kind. Or that would be of interest.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. People who are into drums would be all over that. They're like, wow, this dude plays in a band, and here's what he thinks. And that's the way you build fan base, and that's exactly the way these things promulgate.
Even in 140 characters, it's about content. It's about saying something that people are interested in. For Merlin, his content is humor. He was very funny. You know, I try to put in interesting links and, you know, kind of stuff that I'm doing that's unusual. They had Tom Petty or somebody from his retinue during the Super Bowl on Twitter briefly. And it was a lot of stupid stuff like, well, we're sitting backstage ready to go out. But it could have been something really interesting had somebody sat down and actually said something.
People just really like to interact, which is what makes it so much fun. I mean, I did one of those sort of lame, here's what I'm doing today sort of tweets where I was just saying, gee, I don't know whether I should go shopping for a few pairs of casual pants or gouge my eyes out with a rusty spoon, and got lots of tweets in reply from fellow dudes who knew exactly what I was talking about, but also with some people saying, oh man, you should order your pants from the internet. I bought these
people who didn't get it, but still got it.
And I'm now wearing a pair of internet pants and they're fabulous.
That is hysterical.
They have that enhanced padded seat to help.
That's
with
right. Extra time spent sitting
You don't get
and special tubes connected to it.
Dorsal fatigue.
They're built-in stadium pals now, which is great, I think.
the crotch is specially cut for the massive balls you have to have to take part in most of internet discussions.
You guys, I seem to remember, is it Carl that does your website? Does he still do that?
Absolutely.
And you guys, I remember you guys being in front of this stuff a really long time ago. I guess, did that start as a... Because, I mean, it seems like you guys have been pretty connected with your fans from early on. And I just remember that being a really great, one of the first comprehensive sites I remember that was actually kind of sanctioned by the band. You know, this is before MySpace and any of that. You guys were out there putting up the lyric stuff and encouraging a lot of engagement.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's a huge opportunity. I just don't know what the hell it is.
Nobody does.
I know. I could Twitter that. And boom.
And that's the beauty of it. Nobody does.
Part of it though is that you're providing it's an interesting diversion, but you're providing a certain kind of existential spackle between records, for one thing, between records and tours. Is, you know, unless you're the Smiths and you can put out, you know, another version of This Charming Man every couple months, you don't have product necessarily that you're going to put out all the time, but you're keeping this conversation going with the people who are really engaged with what you do. And so even if you do that in a fairly, I'm not necessarily pimping Twitter for this, but I think it's interesting to watch artists who, even on a kind of high level, somebody like John Hodgman with his blog, like people or Colton for that matter, who are out there like kind of actively staying in touch with people, even when they don't have something to pimp. And to me, that's the long game for this, is being engaged.
The unfortunate thing still at this point is the people you're reaching are a very narrow niche of people. I mean, I think eventually it's going to become a larger slice, right?
But they're not all narrow. Some of them are pretty wide.
They got a skosh more room.
Internet users, a group, by the way.
Say again, we lost that. Scott, go ahead.
I'm president of the horizontally challenged internet user group. So some of us are indeed wide.
But I think that, you know, what we saw with what Nine Inch Nails did was taking full advantage of a very, very narrow group, very niche group. You know, there's only 2,500 people who wanted to pay $300 or whatever for
it. Worked. Set. Yeah, it worked.
It did it, and it was direct, you know, but it is something that, you know, they've been kind of building up for a long time, putting up entire songs in GarageBand so that you can look at how. I mean, I
love that, by the way.
That was a master's course in mixing.
Yeah, Patrick, you. I mean, you guys do use MySpace. Do you find that of value to you?
I think Rivers, out of all of us, values that sort of interaction the most. He's got a MySpace blog and whatnot, and I have a site too, but I've been so slack in updating it that. Because I get sick of me. I'm like, who the hell is going to want to listen to what I have to say? I'm just going, what am I going to like rant about something that I'm going to go read it 2 weeks from now and go like, shut up.
You see, you got to get over that.
I think I have to revise that. I'm going to revise that. I'm going to get on Twitter.
You got to get over that, Patrick. You got to kind of start to think that everything you say is a pearl and it'll be able, you'll fit right in with everybody else.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, Rivers is the front guy though, right? It makes sense the front guy would kind of, you're sitting in the back.
Well, that's true, but we're sort of switching it up now. Like, I have a song on the next record Scott and Brian do, and I think Rivers wants less frontman responsibility because all along I don't think he's been that comfortable with the role.
Sounds like none of you are. Sounds like none of you want to be in front.
Well, that's all changed here today, thanks to you guys.
We're putting you right up front.
Do that, Kelly. You should do that Kelly Keegi Night Ranger thing where you put your setup like right stage sideways.
Dude, that's so,
you know,
burnt.
Get some. Pat, do you even use fingerless gloves at all? Or
you rule, Pat. I'm picturing Sister Christian right now.
Sure are. He sang it. Kelly sang it. That's right.
He sang it like a man too. You know, and that's back when men were men.
Even if their hair was big.
And
well,
chest
afraid. You weren't afraid to dress like a spaceman or a surgeon in a hard rock. I think the kids today, they're all about the slouchy jeans and the spiky belt. I don't want to go all Bill Cosby on you, but I'm just saying, get out there, you know, live it, wear it.
Dude, Bill Cosby all the way. Here's what I don't want to see. Can you get your black hair out of your face and stop moping? That's what I want to say.
I thought you were emo, Patrick.
That's what I thought too, but then I met emo people and I'm like, no, I guess I'm not emo.
Then you should go to LiveJournal. That's the space you want in for Live.
Yeah. Dude, I had Facebook, I had a MySpace, and I just realized, what am I doing? Maybe I'm too old. Maybe I'm just past.
Are you typing in all lowercase? That helps.
I do.
No punctuation.
It bugs me.
Yeah.
It bugs me that I want to have correct punctuation.
Mm. Well, no, I'm the same way. Well, I do that in IM. I type like a, like almost like I'm using a quill pen. Like I everything is, you know, perfect grammar as much as I can.
My kids mock me for that. Literally. I'm not making it up. They say, why are you putting commas in there?
You know what you might also do is, Leo, tell him about Ustream. That's one that he might be interested in.
I don't know. Are you in the studio often, Patrick?
Every day.
See, that's another thing you could do. We're starting to do more of that, which is streaming. he's gonna love this.
He's gonna really be excited about this.
He's gonna love this streaming live video of what you do as you do it.
Like Justin TV,
exactly.
Yeah, oh, man, I'll be tuning a snare for 2 hours.
I think you'd have 1,000 people wrapped watching that, just saying, "Wow."
Do you guys read Idoru by William Gibson?
Yes, it's that exactly.
Yeah. It sounds like that.
Idoru is about a synthetic teen idol, right?
Yeah, and it's like kind of like, I guess the underlying theme is the sort of like the sentient ability of something like that.
Right. Do you feel like an Idoru sometimes?
No.
No. Good. Good. I know Merlin does.
Oh, are you kidding me? Huh? Now I was just searching Audible to see if Idoru was up there, because it'd be such
It'd be a good pick.
You know, I want to see, I'm a huge fan of William Gibson and like Neal Stephenson. I want to see movies made out of those things, but then I start thinking,
spoil it.
They'll jack them up and it won't be right.
You know, I have a bootleg copy that Cory Doctorow gave me of William Gibson reading Neuromancer.
Oh, man.
And it is not available anymore. It was available at one time. And apparently Gibson says that was a lot of work. I would really like that to come back out somewhere. I read the whole darn book. He's good at it, too.
That's a good example, though, Leo. This is actually, I think this happens. I don't think it's any secret. There's people like David Allen putting out, you know, CDs. There's this disconnect between the production of the thing. So, like, you could go and you could be Weezer, or you could be David Allen, or you could be Gibson.
Can I be Weezer?
You could be Weezer.
Okay.
And totally.
I'll be the Bieber. Please. But you could go out and make something that's really, really awesome. And then the whole way of getting that into a channel where it sells in a way that is, you think, reasonable is like this whole other game. And that's, you know, I think we used to always think of that process as being very, you know, kind of carved from the same stone. But I mean, do you sense that at all, Patrick? Do you feel like, you know, do you wish you had different options for like controlling that stuff, you know, before it lands in the notional, you know, Tower Records or whatever?
You know, I think the biggest thing we've learned is you really can't control very much. You just do what you do, and things fall where, let the chips fall where they may. And, you know, if people are into you, they are. I feel like our lives are so complex, like thinking about, I get sick of thinking about stuff like, oh, I got to go talk to Spin Magazine.
Right.
Oh, well, be careful. Don't say what you said last time. Right. And like, you know, F that. I just want to say what I want to say.
Do you get sick of marketing per se, or of having to worry about what you say?
What I don't like is when you can tell that the interviewer is at least uninterested and at worst hostile.
Right.
But then you want to be earnest.
Right.
And then, but you can tell, like, I mean, we've been burned so many times. Like, believe me, we've stepped in it on our own accord a million times. But
I think when you said you were bigger than Jesus, that was really a mistake. I just want to say that right now.
Well, I can't tell you how many times, like, I started to get the idea, like, you know what? I'm going to start taping these interviews.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put it up. And people can, let's compare and contrast.
Because
it has nothing to do with what we've
said. I've done that before. I've totally done that before.
I do think that that's actually the power of things like Twitter and MySpace and all these things, your blog, whatever, that you can bypass, and you can disintermediate. You can bypass the middleman and go directly to your audience. And frankly, that's all the audience wants. They don't want to listen to some snotty spin columnist. They want to hear what you have to say.
Oh, there goes that cover.
I mean, Rolling Stone. Hey, let me. Do you want to hear a little bit of the first couple of sentences of Neuromancer read by William Gibson? Just to wet your whistle. Stuff you cannot get. I probably shouldn't play this.
This is a friend's copy.
This is a friend.
It.
I don't know where I don't know where this came from. There's some music at the beginning. I don't know who put that there. There's an orchestra. Apparently, there's an orchestra tuning up. I don't know what that has to do with Neuromancer. Skip. Come on. Bill, talk.
Sure, that's not the next necromancer by
ridiculous.
Rush.
Maybe it's necromancer. Yeah,
it's not by Rush. Like
that's the wrong. That's the wrong cut.
As he shouldered his way through the crowd around.
Here he comes.
The door of the chat. It's like my body's developed this massive drug deficiency. It was a sprawl voice and a sprawl joke.
He's got a Texas accent. It's great. What are you laughing at?
You know this is being recorded and other people are supposed to be listening to it.
Yeah, does it remind anybody else of Harrison?
Okay. First of all, are you sure that the unit is plugged in? Adapter, sir.
Saigon.
Tell your story.
Yeah, I
sir,
liked it.
He has sir, that... I need the tracking number before I can give you help. What is the tracking number?
No, I am not in India. I am located in a call center in Iowa. This is not going to help you get your TiVo up and running, sir.
Maybe that's why they pulled it out. Maybe it isn't very good. Is that what you're saying?
It's just, well, you're used to like Neil Gaiman. You're used to like all these really good, you know.
Sometimes authors should not read their own material.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right on that one.
I listened to Steve Martin. And
that was great, wasn't it?
So great. It was a great book.
But see, that's a little different because that's him talk. It's a memoir. So he's talking about his life.
Yeah.
And I found it interesting. I'm very interested in one of the reasons I ask you all these silly questions, Patrick, is I'm very interested in what happens. And this, his book is very good for this, Born Standing Up, in that transition between when you're doing what you dig in your art and then suddenly, and then fame. And it's a very, and you know, he's uncomfortable with it. It changed his life in a way that he didn't like, and it changed his art in a way he didn't like. And it's very interesting to hear that transition. So I'm always very interested in that, never having had that experience.
What? Leo Laporte is not famous?
Not as famous as Weezer, baby.
Dude, you're like syndicated.
So you did that W on the back of the logo, didn't you? You did that, didn't you?
I did do it. I was ripping Van Halen off. This is like 1991.
It does look a little like that. Yeah.
I totally ripped it off. And there you go. Now other people think, oh, is that Whataburger? What is that? It looks just like Whataburger.
I like it.
I so miss Whataburger. That's the only thing. Not the only thing. It was one thing I miss about living in the South is Whataburger. Oh, man.
I have William Gibson reading Whataburger. Would you like that?
Now, Patrick, to bring this back on a minute.
Please, thank you, Alex.
Hold on, wait, is that a rat hole?
Yes. Oh, this guy listens to the show.
Yeah. So the
I'm subscribed to MacBreak Weekly, to Twit, to Cranky Geeks, and Left, Right, and Center.
I don't know that one. Right, and Center.
That's NPR.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, that's actually great. I have heard that. Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
So,
wow.
Patrick, are you using Logic to mix stuff down?
I'm using it compositionally and as a mix mm-hmm. thing.
So that's kind of your main software for that? For putting together the albums?
The band uses Pro Tools, which...
You loathe appropriately.
I don't like it, and I know it's great for like that type of the way that your mind works. Like I think the particularly like engineering type person loves Pro Tools, but for some reason, I mean, I've tried everything: Nuendo, Cubase, you name it, Traction, and for me, I just can't get anything done in Pro Tools. And plus, I think you know there might be something wrong with you get a ton of tracks and the mix bus gets kind of choked sounding, but that's very esoteric.
So, and did you find that it was a steep learning curve? A lot of people who come from Pro Tools find that Logic is a hard one to get their head around. It's just so different.
Not at all. In fact, I have a hard time with Pro Tools. I mean, I must have tried it forever. And I have an MBOX sitting right here just because we'll get a session and I'll open it up. First thing I do is consolidate and export it to Logic.
Interesting.
Draw us a picture of your setup in there. This is your home studio.
Yeah, like basically I have it's one room, like about a 10-foot ceiling. It's about 10 feet by 16. It's just a tiny little room. But dudes, I just do yourself a favor and go to Costco and get the Vizio 42-inch LCD 1080p. Because I'm rocking it out of the MacBook and you can't believe for $900 you have such a ridiculously good...
You're driving a 42-inch display out of your MacBook.
Dude, and I'm using the MacBook display. It's awesome.
Wow. And you're using that for Logic.
I'm sorry, MacBook Pro.
MacBook Pro, yeah. Well, yeah. It's not using the native resolution. Maybe it is. Well, I don't know what the native resolution of that
is. Oh, it's 1:1 pixel, Mac.
Oh,
it's
that's
awesome.
Cool. Is it a 1080p monitor?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
I was shocked.
That's your second monitor?
For $900.
Oh, I got that on the wall.
Apple wants twice that for a 30. No.
I almost bought a Mac Pro today, but I held off.
Wait till I buy one, Patrick. Right, yeah.
Wait till Leo buys one.
Yeah, wait till I buy one. I'm about to buy one. That's almost sure bet that something's going to change.
Well, isn't that, where's that site that says when's a good time to buy a Mac? They're like, don't buy it.
Oh, yeah. What was that rumor? I forgot about that. The we haven't looked at that in a while.
Yeah, I ignored it. I bought it on Monday. I bought mine on
release. Buyer's Guide. There's one, a good one, at buyersguide.macrumors.com.
Okay.
That's exactly Mac Rumors. It.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're going to buy a Mac Pro, Leo?
No, I'm not. No.
Come on.
No.
I'll buy one if you buy one.
No, I'm not. Honest, I'm not.
Positions and their peer pressure trying to put their alternative lifestyles on you, Leo. Don't just...
I don't want to. No, I think I may buy a Mac Pro.
That's what I meant.
One of the 8 ways, yeah. I'm close to buying one of those because for the streaming video of the project that we want to do, I think I want to put it on a pretty heavy-duty machine. So I think that's what I'll get. So I'll let you know. That'll be in the next month or so.
Well, I've got that. I've got, like I said, I run Logic on that. I got some good mics and preamps.
What kind of mics do you like to use for I presume miking the drums.
Well, actually, you know, I have a V Drums kit, which will, yeah, it's like a Roland kit, but I don't use the internal sounds. I just record the MIDI, and then I use like, Reason Drum Kits 2.0 is astonishingly good sounding. And
are you recording? What are you recording the special goodness with? Are you doing that yourself?
I'm probably going to do that all old school and probably use tape too.
Wow. And a 4-track.
No, that'll be like a big 2-inch machine with a giant console, like total Led Zeppelin style.
That's awesome.
32-track, buddy.
8-track or 16, 32? How many tracks?
That would be a 24-track machine.
That's good. That's
you can
good.
Get them that's for nothing.
I got a tape splicer if you need to borrow it.
That's a big. That's a 2-inch tape. That's a big block. You're going to cut that with. Jeez.
And they smell good too.
So really, you can buy those now cheap. They're around, used, I presume.
Yeah, there's studios. I mean, you can't believe it. Every studio I walk in, you know, 15 years ago, there's $80,000 machine. Right. Now it's like, get it out of here.
Wow. That is tempting.
It is until you realize that you can't buy tape.
Oh, that's true.
You can get it on eBay.
It's about $200 a reel. Ooh. That's 15 minutes of tape.
Oh, forget that.
At 30 IPS, mind you.
Well, that's the thing. It's very satisfying when those things are spinning at 30 IPS. Just feels like you're really doing some work there.
I'll tell you something. There's something to be said about not putting music into a AD converter. Until you absolutely have to. Like, I'm not one of those guys who's like, you know, analog, dude, it's the only way. Because we've shot stuff out all over the place. And I think digital stuff can sound really, really good. But, you know, like, if it makes you excited to use tape, it's cool. I would do it.
Doesn't sound any worse, I guess.
Some people say the high end is a little smoother because it kind of rolls off.
Right.
But, The real trick with digital recording, especially Pro Tools, is don't record anything hotter than -12. There's a little bit of a technical rat hole for you.
Wait a minute. I have the theme now. We'll play that theme so you feel
comfortable. Rat hole.
Feels good to have it back. That's nice.
Oh, we missed it. All synthetic.
Music in general.
The entire thing is synthetic. There's not even the voice is fake.
The -12.
-12. That's interesting.
Yellow is a lot of hits. In Pro Tools, yellow is the new red.
Everything down right now.
Well, that's one of the big differences on tape. You don't clip. You distort, and sometimes that's an effect people want.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you hit if you hit tape just right, it gives you just enough of a like a compression that it makes things real pleasing. And also, a lot of the gear that you use, like a console, like a really good old console, has huge headroom. Like with digital, like if you clip a converter, it's kind of an unpleasing sound. But if you clip a desk, like a big console, it just kind of makes it more exciting sounding.
Huh. We went from tape to digital. Now we're going from digital back to tape. And then we also have digital that makes it sound like tape. So what's next?
Dude, I have it all. And every day, ask me something, I'm doing something different. Like, I just put Ubuntu Studio on an Athlon. And that was right after I put some dude's OS 10 rip on there. I put that on there. And that was like, whatever. Okay, I'm not doing that. And then I gotta go buy this 4-track. I'm like, sweet 4-track analog. I got nothing.
This is great. You're a big fat geek, Patrick Wilson.
That's true, man. It's the worst. I'm trying to not be, but I can't.
Why? Why stop it?
Because I'll tell you what. It makes me a mile wide and an inch deep.
Wait a minute. I'm gonna have to think about this for a while.
That's pretty deep, right there, dude.
Not specializing.
Exactly.
Do you
feel like you're an audio dilettante?
Well, musicians, especially, I think, dude, the best stuff I ever recorded was on a 4-track because I wasn't thinking about, oh, I got to get my latency right. Oh, my plugins. Right. It's like, let's just plug the mic in and record your damn song.
You mean like a Tascam, like with ping ponging, that kind of 4-track?
Fostex.
Dude, I got a Marantz. Can you believe that? What?
That's sexy.
It is sexy. It's got VU.
I used to bounce the living crap out of stuff. It was awful. It was just where you do 3-to-1.
Are you on a cassette or reel to reel?
Oh yeah, back in the day, I put out like five people bought them, I would just sit there with a big old malt liquor and a Tascam and bounce, bounce, bounce.
Whose idea was it to put Buddy Holly on Windows 95?
That was the label's idea, and they didn't even ask us. And I remember at the time we were like, "What the hell are you doing?" Like, and then we sort of realized, oh, that went out to, I don't know, a billion people.
I think I think it's the first time I saw a Weezer video. I'm sure it was.
That's why the blue record sells more than the other ones.
It might be because of Windows 95. Don't underestimate the value of that.
I love Windows 95. Are you kidding me? That was one of my favorite laptops I had. I had a Dell 233. That thing was awesome.
Were you pissed off that they went to Brian Eno to record the startup sounds for Vista? You could have done that, man. Or no, it was Fripp. Was it Robert Fripp?
No,
it was
Eno. Robert.
It was Eno? Fripp did Vista, and Eno did, I think Eno did 95.
Oh, no, of course. I'm sorry. Yeah, he did that's correct.
I think Vista was
I was not mad. No, I can honestly say I wasn't mad.
It should start up with a drum solo. That'd be so cool. That'd be cool.
Would be cool.
Patrick, what's the process when you guys start working on music videos? Like, how do you get started, or does a director come in and say, "I have an idea for your video," or do you guys have a sense of how you want it to be shown? How does that work?
Well, first we say, "Don't call me; I'm not doing anything." Because... And then someone convinces you that you have to go do it, and then you spend a lot of money and make a pile of junk, and then someone comes in and fixes it for $5, and then you're like, "That's a good video." So.
How did it work with Spike Jones?
Let me tell you something. If you can find on YouTube, we did a version of We Are All on Drugs that was, all we did was we recut a video from an 80s metal band, and we put our music on it. Kind of like that Saint Saunders guy. You ever seen him? On YouTube, it's like Clapton Shreds, any of the Shreds videos.
Oh, right. Yeah, that stuff is awesome.
They're so funny. That's
Fear the
Reaper,
No One Escapes His Evil Power, that one.
Now, is this the official one or the unofficial one?
The unofficial.
Because there's one that's the official one. From Universal Music. But this is not the one you're talking about. The smoke machine in your living room.
That's the big stone that says Fear the Reaper, No One Escapes His Evil Power.
That's exactly right.
So look for We're All on Drugs first version.
Well, I have one here, but it's got a big disclaimer. This is an unofficial video of Weezer's We Are All on Drugs. All material is copyrighted. That one?
Maybe.
I think this might be a user's remix of this.
It might be. You know what? I'm not even sure if it got out. I was sure it got out, but my point was...
Oh, here it is. First version.
Yeah. We spent...
Yeah, it says Fear the Reaper. No one escapes. Oh, this is awesome.
They've said that these budgets have really dropped back. Are they? You know, what's a budget for a typical video?
Dude, they don't have any money. Right. It's amazing how weird it's getting.
20 cents.
Yeah, like 15 cents, basically.
This is a good video. I'm sorry, I'm watching this.
How great.
I like the torches and where you're in a lake. What is it, Mad Max?
It's not even us.
Who is this?
I forget the name of the band. It was like Man of War. Or
you
something.
Took somebody else's video and you put your music behind it.
And it wasn't even us. Like a friend of our managers did it. He was like, "Check this out. This is awesome."
I like that. So that's We Are All on Drugs first version from Mega Man 035.
It's the only version, if you ask me.
That's the one.
Kind of sucks. I mean, this drives me crazy. I know this isn't you, but if you get an ear with those big shots at Universal that you're always having crepes with, what is the deal with not letting them embed videos? Like, you can't embed anything from Universal from YouTube.
They're not alone. In fact, CNN just started making a big, or no, MSNBC just started making a big deal about you can embed their videos finally. Nobody lets you embed video.
Which is funny. Why would you put it on?
I don't get it.
I mean, I like to say it's like some executive, like some chief marketing officer read the first paragraph of an in-flight magazine story about the internet and then stopped. It's like the whole point of it is letting people spread it.
Right.
I mean,
it's just not getting it.
Let's segue then into like the whole idea of locking stuff down versus, fighting human nature. I mean, I just don't get it.
But so now you have some interest though in people paying you for your work.
I do, but it just seems like more and more your work is an advertisement for you. You know what I mean? Like the recording is an advertisement for the idea of you. I hate to say brand.
Do you like that or dislike that?
I like it because I'm still thrilled that anyone gives a rat's ass what I'm doing.
Right.
Like, I think it's awesome. Like, dude, you want to download my song? Go ahead.
Right.
I want you to listen to it. I want it to get burned into your brain so that you come see us play.
And you get paid. And you get paid then by the concert ticket or the merchandising.
Yeah. I mean, I want to get paid for recordings because it's a lot of work, at least for us. It's like a massive struggle to make ourselves happy.
What do you think about what Billy Bragg just said with the Bebo sale? We deserve a cut of that because we made Bebo.
I just posted on an engineer's website about that. I don't think he has a leg to stand on personally because the terms were clear when he agreed to it. He was like, "Hey, I'm going to put myself on Bebo to get some exposure. That's the end of the deal." And no one is stopping someone else from creating a Bebo that is more equitable towards the content producers. So for me, it's like too bad.
Well, and are you really getting hurt if you are making most of your money with merchandising and touring anyway? I mean, how much money, what percentage are you really losing from that prospect?
Well, like I said, like, the record sales, like there's money in publishing, but there's not so much money in the sales of the records anymore.
Right.
And there never really was. And I mean, even like Michael Jackson, I don't think was ever getting, you know, he wasn't doing joint ventures. I don't think he was still on the short end of the stick regarding,
Who made the dough was Quincy Jones. I mean, isn't writing where all the money is?
And producer.
There's a lot of money in writing and licensing, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, like, he co-wrote a lot. Not all of Thriller, and got the production credit, so he probably got points.
Why do you think Michael Jackson bought the Beatles catalog?
Yeah.
That's where the money is. That's an investment.
Right, where the money is.
Yeah.
Totally.
But what do you think, Patrick, when, I mean, I understand that there's a more open attitude towards sharing copyrighted work with the idea that there's promotional involvement there and you might benefit some other way. How do you feel when someone actually takes your music and wraps it in some manner where they profit by it and you don't?
Well, it pisses me off. Yeah. I mean,
see that, there is a line that people can cross is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I think you're right. And maybe I was a little harsh on Billy Bragg because I don't want to be pedantic about like the terms of that agreement. I get what he's saying. Like, hey, you built this off my partially my back. But I kind of made a funny argument. Like, what if people went to Bebo and listened to Billy Bragg and they were like, "Oh, this stinks. I'm never coming back to Bebo." Does that mean
then he owes them money?
Doesn't he have to owe them money?
That assumption they always had these incredibly. I mean, I don't know the details of this particular thing, but so often when they come up with these crazy numbers about lost revenue on sales, it's based on the idea that everybody would have bought that Britney Spears record, which is not accurate. And the thing about that video, the thing about the Universal thing that drives me nuts though, is it's a video for a song. Like the video for Buddy Holly cannot be embedded. Why? And to me, that's like saying, like, you have to pay us a nickel for this press release, or you're not allowed to make a Xerox copy
of it.
It's
crazy.
It's nuts, you know?
Is part of that due to the fact that they might have union crews that are working on that video that would insist on getting a cut of whatever?
No, those people have nothing to do with those deals, at least in our respect. I agree with you. I just don't want to see, just let it go. It's an advertisement. It's like, get people thinking about you.
Yeah, I mean, MTV played that thing in high rotation nonstop. Why not keep it going? And it was smart to put it on the Windows 95 disc. Why not keep it going? Let people embed it.
Any artist will tell you that, like, that you only earn back. You're not going to earn back after. I mean, probably at the time that Pinkerton came out. I mean, obviously the Blue record had done well, but isn't it fair to say that you really start earning on back catalog once you get three or four records? That's when you start really seeing some dough.
Well, you got to recoup, and then. Generally, your next record is it's a tiered deal, so you probably make more on each successive record. So, but they're all crossed, meaning you have to pay back any debts from the previous, from the new. You know what I'm saying? It's called a cross-collateralization.
Basically, it's funny accounting so they can keep as much as possible of what you make.
what do you think of the Steve Albini article? Do you think that's still true?
What did Steve Albini say before we...
Oh, I'm sorry, Steve Albini. You tell him, Patrick.
You go. You know more than I do.
Well, no, just that Steve Albini put out this very famous essay that almost everybody has a strong opinion about, called "The Problem with Music," and I think he's mostly reacting to the post-grunge boom. And basically, he does what he considers to be really strong math on what happens to the average like band that you like that gets signed, and the numbers are unbelievably awful.
Here's the thing, though. You don't have to be a douchebag and do everything that he says that people do in that. It's like,
right.
Yeah, go spend $2,000 on the drum doctor to come make your drums sound good. You know, you got to do this and that. You don't have to do any of that stuff. I mean, like you say, like Jailhouse Rock, hello, put people in a room with a microphone and be rad. That's how you be rad.
What I really want to know is, though, how much of being a credible band, I mean, being able to do... taking the sound that's inside your head and put it onto a really good, you know, make a good recording of it and also get it out in front of people. How much of that is reliant on having people who know how to market and know how to get stuff on tour, know how to mix things? You're telling me that the cheapest record that you made cost $120,000. Yep. And I think that's something that sort of gets lost, that somehow needs to come up with 120 grand. Or even let's cut that in half and make it a budget. Not a whole lot of garage bands have $50,000, $60,000 to produce a really good sounding record that'll help them make money on tour.
Well, you don't really, in some ways you don't need that anymore, because so much of the expense of that first record was on things that you can go to Guitar Center and buy for nothing. But what you do need to spend money on is people who are really smart with their ears and know how to produce. Like, you can give someone all the best gear in the world and it can sound like junk, and you could, like you say, you could record on a 4-track and it could be amazing sounding. So I mean, like Beck's Loser, that was a huge song and it was done on an 8-track, a half inch 8-track. I mean, it's not even that big a deal anymore.
How much does the producer impact your final product?
A producer?
Yeah, the producer sitting in the studio with you working on the...
Well, at our level, it's we want a producer to extract out of us things that we didn't even know we could do.
Right.
I think a lot of bands go through they'll get big on their first record and they'll be like, no, that's not what we wanted. We're going to do this our way. And then they have a sophomore slump.
Well, that was the perfect example is like the Posies, you know, when their first album was, you know, the record company kind of produced it. And the second album, they had a lot more control, and that was one of the big problems, that they just didn't have they had a hard time moving the next one.
It's true. I mean, it's a very complex subject because bands are, you know, people get famous, then they go, what the hell just happened? Oh, it must be because of this. And then they're wrong. And then you grow. It's so ridiculous what happens to you when you become successful. It's
Did you find in the first album that you had to give up a lot more control than you do now? Was the record company really pressing down to make sure that they get a certain sound?
No, that's the irony. Like, they didn't even care about us. They were like, whatever. Here's a hundred grand. Get out of my face. Go get a haircut. And like, and so that kind of like left it to ourselves, to us and Rick. You know, they probably just figured, well, Rick's there. It'll be fine.
Now, did they bring Rick in?
Talk about Rick Ocasek of the Cars, right?
Yeah. Well, right. Here's how it works. You sign to the label because you make friends with an A&R guy. This is how it used to work. And then he's your guy. He's your bud. He's the dude who shows up on Friday at the marketing meeting to pimp you to the company. Like, just because you get money doesn't mean you can get them interested in what you're doing.
Right.
And that was the irony, because I think we just happened to come along at a point where they had nothing else going on, and like, let's put Undone on the, see if we can get that on the radio. And then boom, it's massive.
Right.
That was funny. That first broke big on our college rock station. I mean, exactly. in the same way that, like, God, there's so many bands around that time, like Sloan, and, well, they never broke very big, but there are all these bands that, like, kind of, even like Nirvana, definitely first caught on our college stations, and they were doing a heck of a job with marketing you guys.
What happens now, though? I mean, who breaks
I'll tell
music
you.
Now?
I'll tell you what happens. They go, what should we do?
Help us. You're young and hip, yeah. And we're wearing white pants, and we don't know.
I mean, obviously, we're going to service our music to radio still, because we're still played a lot on radio, like especially alternative. And you hope that you can get a top 40 song. And what are you going to do?
Do you find it still important to work through work up slowly through the CMJ ranks before you go to a pop station? Do you find that's important to keep?
You can tell this is an old record promo man talking right now.
Sorry, I used to work for Sony. So college music journal. Do you pay a lot of attention to those stations still, or do you mostly are you mostly working with AOR and commercial alternative rock?
Like I said, as far as like how we service our music to those outlets, that's the label's problem.
It's not your problem.
That's the label's problem. Like
you just make the music
hire people to help us do that, but mostly we're just trying to make, like, at this point for us, we have a pretty decent fan base, so we can just put out, as long as it's decent,
right.
It'll have a modicum of success. Like look at In Rainbows by Radiohead. There's not a single on that thing, but it's
right.
Awesome.
So if you're a young band starting out that doesn't have that built-in audience, is radio going to help you? Probably not.
You can't get on the radio.
No. So where do you go? What do you do? How do you get started? What would your advice be to somebody?
First thing, Google the KLF Manifesto, which is KLF was a British thing that was like late 80s, early 90s. And they wrote an amazing book called the KLF. I think it's called The Manifesto. And it's an amazing read about... If I had read this, I would have saved myself 15 years of failure. Like personal failure. But it's an incredible read about what's really important about if you want to reach people. And basically it comes down to forget everything and just write a good tune. Just write a good tune.
It's kind of
everything else will fall in line.
It's kind of what Google says. Just do good
content.
It's
absolutely true.
Yeah.
Don't go out and figure out how to use Pro Tools. Don't do this. Don't do that. Write a song. Write a song that makes people want to cry, and then you're good.
Do you think excellence will rise? I mean, there are a lot of people writing songs, a lot of people writing blogs. There'll be a lot of people doing podcasts. I mean, there's more content than ever before.
I'm with you. I think it will rise. I think if something is undeniably great, everybody wants it. That's just all there is to it.
So make it great.
Just be great.
Be great. And even if nobody listens, at least you'll know you were great.
Well, that's the thing. People, there is a huge appetite out there. I mean, I'm with you. Like, I think there's too many things there's so much out there that it confuses people. Like, I was confused when I used to go to record stores, like, oh, what did I want? And now I just get on the internet. Now you don't know any. You can't find anything. but you know, if something is seriously awesome, it's going to come out.
Well, I think Theodore Sturgeon said 20% of everything is great. So if you have more stuff, you got more great stuff.
Well, that's another thing too. Keep writing songs. Just keep doing it. Like most band, I think like a huge mistake bands make is they obsess over this one track and like they keep redoing it and redoing it. Walk away. If it's not happening, like bang, 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 put it aside and work on it later. Like when it occurs to you that, you know, you can help it, just move on.
It's true of any kind of creative enterprise that you don't get good by spending all your time on that one thing you think is your masterpiece. You get good by failing often. And learning from that. And the more that you can produce something, it's almost like throwing darts in the dark. The more likely you are to hit something if you're just constantly working, you know, and that's
true.
If you look at people, at least for me, the bands that I like a lot, especially in kind of the, you know, whatever alternative world, they're on a pretty regular schedule. You look at somebody like the Mountain Goats and they're putting out an album a year and then touring behind it. And they've built, like they're building with every record. They're workmen, right? They're not out there expecting somebody from Atlantic Records to drive up with a limousine, you know, and Led Zeppelin in the back. Like they understand they're going to have to just work really hard inside of a model that's emerging very quickly. And the ones who are making it are working. They're not sitting around and whining. They're figuring out how to engage with their fans and then go out and like, and move some shirts. That's what they're doing.
It's a cliche, but like, if I see someone on a stage and I can tell that person is in love with what they're doing, like, and it's pouring out of them, that's just complete, that's totally infectious. That's what I want to see. That's what I want to see.
By the way, I overstated Sturgeon's Law. It's 90% of everything is crap.
I was going to say, boy, I think that's a little...
and sometimes
you're citing the Pareto crap principle.
That was the Pareto principle. 80-20 principle instead of the 90-10 principle. We're going to take it. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
No. One thought from Patrick Wilson.
Well, I want to get into what you guys think about the logistics of filtering and what kind of pressure can be put on ISPs and what's, you know, like, isn't there something happening in France, like some legislation?
Yeah, it's kind of a mess right now because Comcast has admitted to using Sandvine to literally break BitTorrent seeds. Yeah. And I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's only one candidate that I know of that supports net neutrality. I think that that's one thing to do is when you vote, if you're a U.S. citizen and you're voting in the election in November, is to consider which candidates support net neutrality and make sure that they even know what it is.
Say
which candidate sat down and talked with Larry Lessig about this stuff. There's one.
Only one.
That's right.
We won't say any names. I want you to do some research.
We don't want letters.
He will remain nameless.
And it ain't,
he's not Republican.
And it ain't John McCain.
Yeah, there we go. Won't say who it is. We actually talked. We've been talking a lot about the filtering within within at This Week in Media. So another little podcast that we do, and a lot of it is. You know, instead of fighting it, one of the big things that we're starting to see Verizon talk about, and we don't know how much PR it is actually experimenting with using the servers at the ISPs to actually be able to become more efficient. If they're not, what was very inefficient for the ISPs is to be sending to torrents. Someone's pulling a torrent. And they're grabbing bits from people all over the world, and that's expensive and inefficient for the ISPs because they do have a point where they have to go back and forth between each other. If you're pulling a torrent down of whatever you're torrenting, and it goes, oh, by the way, I can see that there are a whole bunch of seeds that are within the ISP, within the servers that are here or more local, and I feed them to each other, the user gets their measurement was up to six times faster. They get a much faster download, as well as it costing a lot less for the ISP. And the thing about that is that, you know, this is what they could be doing instead of sitting there trying to cut everyone off by the knees.
Well, of course. But like, my point is what is the mechanism that's going to force people's hands? Like, does a label go to Verizon and say, look, either you figure this out or we're going to sue you. We're going to take you to court. Like, where is that line that where the inertia gets moved out of the way?
Verizon has I think what Alex is talking about is probably the only solution, because Verizon's issue is not merely they're worried about DMCA notices from the record labels over allowing sharing. They're also worried about the hit the network takes, which is not insignificant. You get it, four or five guys sitting there downloading 18 copies of the Titanic, and it's going to kill the bandwidth for everybody else. And I think that's not an unreasonable thing for them to say, we've got to manage this somehow. I mean, I think that's really what they're trying to do. I don't think that they're trying to make a political statement. I think they're just trying to manage their bandwidth consumption. And the Verizon's P4P solution is one way to do that, is to say, okay, this is what our users are going to be doing. Let's figure out a way to do it so it doesn't kill everybody else.
Well, I think also that we have to start thinking about the price structures of a lot of content and so on and so forth. I mean, if we made, I think that if we, I mean, and I'm not saying this is ever going to happen, but if we made DVDs, for instance, if we made a DVD quality, not anything higher, just DVD quality, if you could buy that, buy it, not rent it, for $3.99 or $4.99, almost all of that bit, and you made it BitTorrentable and it was easy, and no DRM or whatever, people would just stop. They just buy it because it'd be too easy. It'd be too hard to go through all the trouble to go out and find the movies when they could just get a pristine copy of it from.
I think that's true for 12-year-olds.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
people who are 12 right now, you think they'd spend $3.99 for whatever frickin' Horton Hears a Who or whatever?
They're not spending $14.99 on it. I mean, the thing is,
they're not spending anything right now.
But you're not losing them. You're losing. I think you're losing the folks that are 18 and above. I think those are the folks that you're losing to some degree, because they don't want to pay $15 or $20 for a piece of plastic that costs 44 cents. You know, and so the thing is getting it down. It's always, I mean, that's what iTunes did. I mean, the reason iTunes has sold whatever 4 billion plus songs is because it's easier to download it from iTunes than it is to go find it on LimeWire or on XTorrent or whatever you're going to find it on. And so the thing is that iTunes made it easy. You know, I wanted to hear a song.
I think it's an Alex thing. I think people who were raised, I think it's profound to me to talk to somebody who's under 20, because it's mind blowing to me how incredibly different their idea of this stuff is from mine. Like you and me, Alex, like personally, I love going to Amazon now. I still love iTunes, but I love going to Amazon. It's super fast. I can buy a record. It's there. I do it all the time, almost every day, to be honest. Don't tell my wife that. But like, I'm not sold on people college age and under ever buying any of this stuff again. I just don't think it's going to happen.
You know what? I think they will, because at some point your conscience will get to you. It will. You will start saying, like, you know what? I download all this crap and I don't even listen to it. I'm going to go find something I'm into.
What event would cause someone who's never bought a record? And if you could go talk to people who are under 20, and they will tell you they have never purchased media in their life.
Yeah.
And go, I'm curious, what is the event, Patrick, that you think would make them have that flash of conscience? Is it engagement with the artist?
Let me ask you, how big of music fans are those people really? Like, are they casual music fans? Because it's my experience that's why the record industry has taken such a big hit, is because they used to be able, they sort of had a captive audience, because people that weren't that into music would see something and be like, oh, I like that, and go buy it. But
the analogy is that people who, so at least for me, I'm 41, so, which I happen to mention every week now as part of the drinking game. But you know, so for me, I think the analogy for me in 1984 or 85 was that radio was basically P2Ps. I would never in a million years think of listening to 98 rock and having to pay for it. But if I wanted to like find out about Husker Du, I had to get in a car and drive to Tampa and spend $5.99 on Zen Arcade, drive it home, and listen to it on the record player and tape it, right? That was that. So what that is I forget the psychological term for this, but it's a very high level of engagement. You had to actually drive to another town. You couldn't go to Camelot to get Husker Du. And so, like, to me, I had a very high level of engagement. And then I'd seek them out, and I'd go buy the shirt, and I'd read about them in magazines. So, I mean, I'm just saying for myself, absolutely. I will buy every Mountain Goats record that comes out. I will buy every Sloan record that comes out. The bands that I really love and support, I will absolutely always buy. I'm just not sold at people who never had.
It's not a moral or an ethical issue. It's more of what was reality like when you were a kid, when you first learned about music.
That's when you started those habits,
that's the reason why the generation that my dad didn't understand the idea of why are you ripping stuff? Why do you think it's a God-given right that you can rip music, you can rip DVDs? Because when I grew up, it was assumed that everyone had a tape player, everybody had unprotected music, everybody was copying things for their own personal use and sharing them in a limited way. However, the origin of that music was always going into a store and buying it. So that's why I feel as though the ability to duplicate and edit music is a God-given right. Similarly, the kids growing up today, they grew up in a world in which if you wanted a piece of music, you can just go out and download it. There wasn't an ethical thing attached to it. That's just the way they grew up. So that connection between an exchange of money and getting the music, that connection never really formed. I think that's why more and more bands and publishers and everybody are going to have to find a new way of getting money out of their pockets.
Well, and I think that there was a lost opportunity when the record industry ran Napster into the ground. I mean, I think that you had 70 million people. You had 70 million people who were sitting there, and if you asked them to pay, if you had asked me to pay $6.95 a month or $9.95 a month, or probably even $19.95 a month for what I was getting, which is more than. It was more than, because I never got anything that was commercially available. I mean, the stuff that I was searching for were like acoustic version of blah, 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 you know, and then you'd find somebody's whatever, you know, and the thing is that just having that and just paying for access to it and then saying, we're going to take 75% of that money and we're going to give it back to whoever the copyright holders are. It would have made more money than just about anything else we could have, you know, that could have done.
The bigger problem is that lost opportunity to once again make sure that the kids who are getting into music in 1993, 1994, 1995, again, so get that Pavlovian response that music comes after I pay money to somebody. And because they basically made Napster, because they made their own pay services completely irrelevant until iTunes came along, they just lost that opportunity for 6 or 7 years. I think that's going to be a big, important gap.
Well, have they really though? Like, what if iTunes, like you guys were talking about last week, what if they say, okay, you got to pay an extra $10 or an extra $20?
I think it's a huge opportunity. I mean, I think that's probably the way to bring that back in.
Right? I think so too.
I think iTunes has to go to subscription.
The cool thing about the P2P stuff was, like you said, like the goofy thing you've never heard of, like, dude, I just ripped this Vince Guaraldi Christmas special off of vinyl. Check it out.
Right. Did you guys ever release your cover of Just What I Needed? That's never been officially released, has it?
Did we cover that somewhere?
Yeah, totally. You did it during the sessions for the Blue Record.
You are such a nerd.
Oh, no, we did. No, we did.
Who was that engineer? Damn.
Berlin, is this a question for your alternative music zine that you're photocopying at Kinko's and stuff tomorrow?
was it a different Cars? It was from the first Cars record.
I remember now, and I remember actually being in the room with Rick while we were playing it, and I was so stoked.
That's a great example. Like, I have so much... Theoretically, I have so much of your stuff that's never been.
Let me just prove that you actually played it, and it's in fact still on the internet.
Let me just disclaim it quickly.
Okay,
the Cars version just kills.
Oh, our
version
is classic. That whole record is so good,
dude. Nobody makes records like that.
No, every song is a hit. Every freaking song is a single on that record. It's insane.
It's a monster.
Okay. Roy Thomas Baker. You should get Roy Thomas Baker to do your next record.
Nope.
Why not?
Well, because he doesn't sound none of the old guy, dude. Believe me, we've had this conversation. Let's go get. We listened to Highway to Hell. Let's go get Mutt Lange. Have you heard Mutt Lange?
That sounds like Shania Twain.
I know. That's why we don't get Mutt Lange.
Sounds like Lucille Ball at age 73 now.
I can help you make a record, no problem.
I said you're just what I needed.
I've been strange. You're moving in stereo.
All right. Let's take a break. We're going to come back with your picks. And I don't know if, Patrick, you prepared a pick, but if you did, and I don't mean a guitar pick. I mean a software, hardware, or website pick. You kind of gave us the Vizio. That was pretty good.
That could be awesome. I'm getting one.
Yeah.
Dude.
Andy's already Twittered it.
I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to give you the money back guarantee. You know what that is? You don't like it, I'm buying it.
Oh, he likes it that much. And only at 50 cents on the dollar, too.
You can bankrupt Weezer. Everybody, go out. If you got $1,000 worth of credit.
I'm thinking of getting one for all the computers here. Just have a whole bunch of these 42-inch 1080p's.
You know, we actually talked to Vizio about being a sponsor, so maybe they're listening.
It's Chris. I'm telling you, it's Chris.
We could help you guys. We could help you. Yes. I do want to mention Audible.com, which is an actual sponsor, an actual paying sponsor. I probably should stick with those. Audible is doing some really cool things right now. There's still the brackets in their first annual tournament of audiobooks. Only four remain. Catch 22, World Without End, The Road, and Pillars of the Earth. So you might want to check out those brackets. If you're following March Madness, forget basketball. It's March Audiobook Madness. Audible.com/MacBreak. You can also get a free book. And yes, there are William Gibson novels on Audible. Not Idoru, but Spook Country, his latest, is on there. And we've recommended that before. Pattern Recognition, which is excellent. I love the idea of somebody who is so hypersensitive to branding that she can pick out the next big thing just because it makes her queasy. It's a great concept. It's a wonderful book. His stuff is very good. And he doesn't read a single one of these, by the way. Just to reassure you. Then I said, so if you want to get an Audible book, I do recommend William Gibson's stuff. It's great. Somebody sent me an email, just a short email saying, listening is not reading. I don't care what you say. It is reading. Every word is there. You actually experience the book in a visceral way that you might not when you read it. I just think it's the best way to
get somebody who listens. Somebody who's like geeked out on your podcast goes, listening is not reading.
Can you believe that?
That takes the Andy Inako sized pants for
that's an internet pant where
that takes internet pants to make a comment like that.
Unbelievable. I said, I think it is. And I left it at that. In any event, it is reading, and it's a great way to read, whether you're in the car or in the gym. There are lots of times when you can't hold a book, but you can listen and get a lot of reading done. It's how I get all my reading done. Highly recommend Pattern Recognition by William Gibson. Get it free by going to audible.com/MacBreak right now. I know you want to be filling up your iPod with Weezer music, and of course I highly recommend that, but just leave a little space, just 100 megabytes for a book, and you'll be very glad you did. audible.com/MacBreak. Now time for our MacBreak picks. You want to hang with that Vizio pick, Patrick, or do you have anything else?
I'm going to go back and reference the manual by the KLF. You can purchase it on Amazon.
It's called The Manual.
The Manual.
And it's KLF, which is the Copyright Liberation Front, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
And basically, it's sort of a how-to book on, if you follow their instructions exactly, they guarantee that you will have a number one hit in Britain. And it's probably a little dated and a little bit topical, but I can't tell you how eye-opening it was for me to sort of internalize what they're talking about. If you're into writing songs,
they were the Time Lords. They're a band.
Yeah. There were a bunch of different things
Do you still? It says here you have to take ecstasy and have a Roland 808. Is that still true?
That is not true. In fact, one of the things in there, like, and when you're in the studio, they say, don't take any drugs and fire anybody who is taking drugs.
They say, don't be on dope, but do be on the dole. Firstly, you must be skinting on the dole. Anybody with a proper job, dole, or tied up with a full-time education will not have the time to devote to see it through.
Dick Van Dyke, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a lovely holiday with Mary. Being on a dole gives you a clearer perspective on how much of society is run. There's the Dick Van Dyke accent.
Like Dick Van Dyke.
No one in Britain talks like that.
Hello, Governor.
Hello, Governor. Would you like to touch the enemy coat?
Been to London 5 times. I have never passed the dancing chimney sweeps, although I look every time I go.
Well, and Bob's your uncle.
Bob's your uncle. Chim chimney cheroo. So there it is. That's the Time Lords. The manual.
Now you sound like Michael Caine. Now you sound like you're from Northern
Michael Caine. How to have a number one the easy way. The Time Lords. Highly recommended. That's a good pick, and that is on Amazon.
That's correct.
Excellent. And you know, it's funny. I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry. Apparently, in the liner photographs of the Chumbawamba album Ready Made's, Boff Wiley is seen to be reading a copy of the manual.
Hysterical.
There you go. Andy Inako, have you a pick for us, sir?
I indeed do. My pick for the week is going to be my internet pants. I was delighted and surprised by how well, like, letting the internet buy my recommend pants worked out, because they recommended a pair of pants that is designed for either like police detectives or people in the military or people who fancy themselves that they could be police detectives or people in the military if they didn't weigh 380 pounds. It is called the 5'11 tactical pant. the tactical pant. It's not
the number. Is that the number of nacho chips you can fit in the pockets?
Exactly. It's not like comic book guy's prescription pants, but it's very, very close.
Did you get the TacLite Pro pants?
Well, see, I was going to say, see, they make two different varieties. They make the tactical pants and the TacLite Pro. The tactical pants are made of 100% cotton, so they're a little bit thicker.
That's the way to go for winter.
For summer weight, they just came out with the TacLite Pro, which is cotton poly. It's a little bit lighter. But the cool thing about them is that they are, let's just say that they are tailored for people who... they're designed for people who squat in alleyways waiting to shoot at drug dealers.
It looks like some of them have built-in knee pads.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what I'm saying is they're cut kind of roomy, which means that if you spend most of your time sitting in an office chair, speaking into a microphone, or doing typing, they're also fit very, very roomy for your lifestyle. They're reinforced at the seat. They're reinforced at the knees. They have a liberal amount of pouches and pockets, but not so much that store detectives will follow you around when you go into the mall thinking that you're there to shoplift.
Looks like they have an iPhone pocket.
There is. I was going to say there is a pocket that is the perfect size for an iPhone
A taser, depending on your.
You don't have it in a case. Well, actually, see that's the interesting thing. These aren't like fake tactical pants. I put them on. They arrived yesterday and I tried them on and I said, well, geez, wow, that's great. That's perfect. That's perfect position for an iPhone. I wonder why they put it on the left leg instead of the right leg. And then I realized that because it's sized for a spare ammo clip.
Yeah, because the right leg has your gun on it.
Because you're holding your gun in your right hand and you're desperately thumbing the release to get the extra clip for the.
That's exactly right.
But so many really nice little details. I'll call out one extra one. The back pockets. I've never understood why on so many pants the pockets are designed so that you can sort of get into them if you have to sort of angle your hand as if you're going down your spine to get at them. The back pockets in these pants are angled so that you can just basically reach in from the side. It's sort of like front pockets on the back. So it's very, very easy to like dig in and, you know, get at that set of car keys or anything you might be storing in there. They're really, really comfortable. Really, really, they're affordable. They're only like $50. I don't think pants should cost more than $50. If I spent more than $50 on pants, my dad would be saying, "What do you think? You're a member of the Osmonds or something? Take those pants back." Okay. As a matter of fact, I like them so much that like that later that day, I did buy a pair of the summer weight tactical pants. available in charcoal, gray, green, fire navy, khaki, Loden, and Torp.
If you're taking dressing advice from anybody on the Mac Week panel, I think you're really Mac Break panel. You really actually have sunk to a new low. But these do look nice. I might get some of these.
Wear these pants to a wedding, and they will think, "Yep, there's a guy who listens to Mac Break Weekly or something even less."
See, I wear Scott Evest pants. I'm wearing them right now. But these would be a good alternative.
Hey, guess what? I'm getting on Twitter. How do I get people to listen to me?
Patrick, what's your login name on Twitter?
We'll all
Patrick underscore Wilson.
Underscore. Oh, we have to help him with that.
Oh, come boy. On, you love it.
What do you think, Merlin? Will that work?
I'm going to add you. Here you go. I'll follow you. You need an icon in there, buddy. Get something sexy. Show a little
bit
of skin.
Just signed up.
Well, I am your. I am following you, my friend.
I'm following him too.
I'm first Twittering thing. People to follow you, and not then I will follow you.
Okay. He's got two followers right now, Merlin and me.
Oh, we'll change that.
How can I do better than that?
You got to update, Patrick. Say something, though. You got to say something.
I'm still setting up. Hold on.
We got Patrick Wilson to Twitter. And we're not talking the Broadway actor Patrick Wilson. No, we're talking the macho manly Patrick Wilson.
The writer of The Music Man. the guy who met Tom Bosley.
There you go. Yeah, that was that the actual Happy Days set, or was that a simulacrum? I don't know. You should Twitter about that. Don't tell me. Put that at your first Twitter.
I've already updated.
Oh, he's updating, man. This is exciting. Okay. Oh, this is exciting. You know, in about 19 more people, I'll have 13,000 followers. Look at that. Patrick Wilson, I'm on Mac Break Weekly.
Here's another one. What?
Twitter. Welcome. Was good. I'm on the toilet right now would be good.
You are listening to people typing and reading things they're seeing on a monitor. Mac Break Weekly, your slurs.
Can I put this on my iPhone?
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Jailbroke on 1.4 bra.
m.twitter.com, I believe. Yes, is that right? Twitter mobile?
Yes. There's also is there an native application I could use?
Yeah, there's a really good one. Bobby Anderson makes that one. Twitterlicious. I'll get it for you here. Oh, I shot my phone off. God. Twitterina? Twitterella.
Is it bad to say you have a jailbroken phone?
No,
we all love it. Scott Bourne passed out a long time ago. It's okay. I'm not kidding. He's gone. I don't know what happened to him. I think after we go a little longer than an hour and a half, he actually falls over in a faint.
Oh, dude, I got 30 followers.
Yeah. Yeah, you're gonna be huge, man. But you now have to say, like, important things.
Well, the cool thing is that, like, the band name Weezer, it almost sounds like an internet service already. So you probably could get venture capital just for that.
Happy days of 70s, 50s.
I will give 10% to anybody who hooks that deal up.
Let's see. Pick. We did Andy's Pants at myinternetpants.com. Mr. Merlin Mann.
Did I ever give the URL?
I don't think you did.
It is actually, they're available from a bunch of different people, but the main site is 511tactical.com. They have tactical shirts, tactical belts, anything that could be proximity to an explosion, they can sell to you.
Merlin Mann.
All right. I'm going to go far outside my usual area. And I know a lot of people are going to make fun of me for this because it shows what an old man I am, but I bought a flip video camera.
You did?
I'm very, very excited about it. It arrived this morning, and I've been playing with it all morning. Flip video camera. It's the size of, if you smoked, like, more 100s. It's about the size of a pack of... Because, you know, when you smoke a long brown cigarette, the ladies flock. It looks like a pack of Moors, and it's crazy, like, most reduced subset. So Jason Fried has written about this. David Pogue has written about this.
He just wrote about it. He said, I don't know why I haven't reviewed this, mostly because geeks look down their noses at this camera.
Oh, it's crazy.
But he loved it.
We've got, Ev is using one now.
It's like the new A-list thing.
Here's the thing. Like, once you understand the model for this, so first of all, let me explain. It has basically a red button on it. That's not entirely true, but to record, you just hit the red button and it starts recording. To stop, hit stop. There's no adjustments. There's no nothing. You can play, you can trash videos, and that's it. It's got a flip out USB thing. Let me flip it out. Can you hear that? There we go. A flip out USB thing. It plugs right in. There's a little app that pulls off AVIs, and you're good to go. But if you're me, like, I've got, you know, Alex, you know that camera we bought to do the Merlin show? We got that tricked out HD.
HV20?
Yeah, HV20, which is this great HD camera. But, like, if I want to shoot the kid laughing, what, I'm going to go get it? I'm going to make sure that it's queued up to the right place. I'm going to pop out the screen. No, I grab this thing with the size of a pack of Moors. I hit it, and I start recording.
You press the red button.
For incredibly casual, easy video, this is looking very
fun. What's the quality, though?
It's not too bad. I think it's 640.
It's like good TV quality.
Oh, actually, Andy, you should talk about this if you used it. I got the Ultra, which is the 60-minute version.
I will say two or three things about it. I love the flip video camera. I reviewed it, like, back in the fall, and for the same reason, it had been out for like a year earlier, and I just ignored it because it looked like a toy. As a matter of fact, if you've been into drugstore and you bought one of those single-use, quote-unquote, video cameras, it's that exact same camera, only with USB, so you don't have to take it anywhere. But it has two things that I just absolutely adore about it. Number one, it runs off of AA batteries, which gives you two big reasons why you'll be able to use this instead of that $1,000 HD camera. I put fresh batteries in it, fresh alkalines in it, and it's just on the desk. I pick it up a month later, and it's still good to go. It doesn't, like, decay. The charge doesn't decay. I don't have to keep it plugged in anywhere. Also, if I'm out on the road and I do wind up with a flat battery, or if it suddenly occurs to me today that, oh, wow, I should take the flip video camera, I don't have to think 4 hours in advance to make sure it gets plugged in. Even if the batteries are dead, I stop off at a pharmacy, and it's good to go. But the other cool thing about it is, I use it so many times when there are places where I just can't fit in a regular video camera. There are times when I do want to do those cool, like, reality show, you know, a dashboard camera sort of things. And it's absolutely flat. It's about like 1 inch thick. So you can easily just paste some Velcro to the back of it, stick it into the corner of the car, and you're good in shooting.
Have you done anything? Is there anything we could see, on the web?
Yeah, actually, if you go to Kung Fu Grip on my blog, I put up a single video so far. It's really stupid, but
well, at least we can see what it looks like, though.
Yeah, Kung Fu Grip, except GRIPPE. It's like if G.I. Joe had the flu.
Is that the native file, or did you recompress it? Is it Flash?
I took it out, I uploaded it to Vimeo, and that's it.
Okay, so it is re-encoded in Flash.
Yeah, and you can see how I look like a catcher's mitt. But I also picked up the Flip tripod, which is basically similar in some ways to, like, not a GorillaPod exactly, but it's like just a little, articulated, what do you call those little legs, with little rubber feet. And
the technical term is bendy.
Bendy legs. Bendy
Alex,
legs.
You're always able to bring in that technical angle when it comes
to
video.
Yeah, you know, that's just me.
That's what he's here for. That's his job.
Okay, so anyway, yes, this is silly and it's toy-like. It almost reminds me of, like, remember that awesome Fisher-Price Pixel Vision, like, back in the 80s? It's, like, except useful. Like, it's the size of this is awesome. I see myself using this a lot. I see this as something, I got the case and the tripod, so this is something I throw in a backpack, and when the baby does something funny, I can record it. Or when my wife does something funny, I can record it. So it's one-fifth of an Alex, $140, available on Amazon at all, and it's fun. Flip video.
Yeah, I when I have, like, my nieces and nephews over, they're not allowed to play with a $1,000 HD camera.
No, right.
But they are. I happily hand them the Flip video, and we imports into iMovie. We can do editing. We can do cool stuff. I would say that it gets used at least as often as the really good expensive camera.
Very cool.
Got one.
Huh?
I have a Flip.
What do you use it for, Patrick?
I hand it to my 3-year-old.
You have a newborn too, right?
Yeah. 3 months. Oh, just slept through the night. First night last night.
Yay! Congratulations.
Car goes crazy.
He's after.
Merlin and I both know that one.
Yeah. So how old's your child?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah. Patrick.
3 months and there's a 3-year-old as well.
Wow. Our grouping's pretty tight. The three of us. I'm, Char's just turning 5
months. What was in the air on that weekend that caused all of you to just say, come on, let's get a bottle of Dubonnet and
let's go warm up. Right, the one evening in February, we all decided to warm up the tube amp.
What night was there nothing on TV? February.
Lost is a repeat. What do you want to do? And we have three newish parents.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Do you use a Flip to take baby pictures?
No. I'll tell you what, though. I'm going to buy one of those goofy little Casios that are awesome on Amazon for like $129. I have a sick DSLR, but what am I going to do with that? Walk around with that like a tourist?
Especially if you're carrying a baby Bjorn or a sling or something, you're going to carry a DSLR around your neck, you know?
Yeah, that's what I got the G9 for. It's a little expensive, you know, a little bit more on the expensive side, but it shoots raw. Canon, and I can put it in my front pocket. Although the Luminex is really good. Well, sorry.
Is raw like that big a deal over like?
Well, here's the deal: is that you're taking photos. If you're taking photos and you're shooting, and suddenly you accidentally shot outside instead of inside, the big thing is that all the color correction is done later, so you can get that blue cast or yellow cast out of it later without any damage to the actual image.
The biggest difference with raw is that JPEG has a limited color palette. With RAW, you're getting stuff right off the image sensor, and so you have a much, much, much bigger box of crayons. It's the difference between when you get the picture home, having a face that's partially in shadow and not really being able to do anything with it. If it's a RAW picture, there's enough color information that's been recorded off of that shadow area that you can pull all those shadows out completely, pull out all these details that are buried. Once you spend a day shooting RAW and seeing what you can do with it, you will go out and buy an eight gigabyte card or 16 gigabyte card. They're going to need to start shooting raw.
I mean, essentially, if you're shooting in JPEG, it's kind of like you're recording audio in 128-bit
MP3. Yeah,
and you're going to do all your mastering on that.
When I take a picture, the symbols are going to sound washy.
Yeah. Exactly. Except in, just think of it visually.
This has been a really illustrative show for me, because now I know what, like, my cousins and my friends think when I'm talking to them about my technology. I'm like, wow, washy. I'm going to use that. I don't know what
washy.
It sounds so technical.
I got washy.
You know what I mean? Like symbols. Like if you have, like, some of my early encodes are like flanging up.
Oh no, I'm playing on my own ignorance. Not that it's you're using a term that's hard to understand. I'm just saying that they're terms I know that I associate with music, and I know that people who are smart about music use them. But I'm like, wow, I can
Wow.
What Andy's audio. Saying is we rarely talk to anybody but geeks. So when they use words outside of our own narrow sphere, we get excited.
You know who's the worst at that is audiophile people. They're like, oh, the bloom.
God, it's got to be in FLAC. Really, we feel like to have the integrity of this. I've done this taping basically through this recorder that I've held over my head, and it's got to be 50 bajillion byte FLAC file.
Here's the worst.
Let me guess. You're using Marantz and French interconnects on that tube. Okay, fine.
Oxygen free.
I've got some that are made in Brazil. We can fix this. We'll have to record it. But
Tapers. Okay. Are you a FLAC guy, Patrick? You big FLAC guy?
You know what, man? I'm going all vinyl. I went through a giant period of newsgroup downloading, like, whoa, FLAC, lossless, whatever. Oh, man. And now, you know what? I could care less. Yeah. I never listen. And you know what?
The part
care?
That's hilarious is the source quality is so awful. These guys are really obsessed with these, like, totally lossless formats for something that, like, just sounds like ass. It's unbelievable.
I don't care because I didn't buy it. That's why I don't care.
Ah, that's true. I think it's true. When you get a concert ticket for free, do you go? No. If you pay $100 for it, you're going to show up.
Do you buy the heavy? Is it 40 gram or whatever it's called? Do you buy, like, the heavy records? The big artisanal?
I don't have any records yet.
He's planning to go vinyl.
You just made a decision.
First, he has to get a turntable.
My Carl that you mentioned earlier has 12,000.
Like 10,000 records? Yeah.
Okay, so that's 12,000. And I made a list of like 2,000 releases that I wanted. I'm like, here, go find these and make sure they're unopened.
Oh, cool.
And then I realized it was going to be prohibitively expensive, and I gave it up.
Have you discussed this with your family at all?
No. Dude, out here in the studio, it's like I'm in the cave.
Okay.
If she knew the stuff that I was buying and like...
Man, she does now.
She does the same thing. Like, hey, what's that on your finger? Oh, I'm...
This is where Twitter's going to get you. Like, what? You bought an original Daydream Nation for $10,000?
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's what Twitter's all about. Keeping spouses together since 2005. let's see. I have a quick pick. Have I done Pukka before? I don't think.
Oh, is it the delicious? The delicious client? No, I don't think so.
I love Pukka. I realized I'm using it all.
I say Pukka.
Well, it's Pukka.
Huh.
I can tell you because I'm going to play it for
Pukka.
You. This is they actually put on their website because of people like you, Merlin. They actually put the pronunciation on their website.
Pukka. I love being a cautionary tale.
Pukka. Pukka.
Hear it? Pukka.
I do.
Pukka.
That should be a lesson in marketing. If you have to have a recording of how your trade name is pronounced, pick another trade.
For a long time when you installed Linux, it would come with one sound file that would say, my name is Linus Torvalds and I pronounce Linux.
I know that.
Just so you'd know how to pronounce it.
If your first name was Linus, you would be really obsessed with pronunciation.
I pronounce Linux. That just cracks me up. Anyway.
Hey, Linux is a big lie. Don't do it.
Linux. The cake is a lie.
Now we're going to get mail.
So
no, you know I'm kidding. I'm running Ubuntu.
He said
we're
going to
get lossless mail.
He was going to put OS 10 on his AMD Athlon. Instead, he decided to put Ubuntu. Then that's a man.
Dude, I had it on. I had OS 10 on, and like then I was like, I can't get that.
It was kind of washy.
I couldn't get it working.
No, it stinks. You got to have a Mac to use OS 10.
We're done in doubly, I think.
Doubly. It's in doubly. If you've done it in doubly. Pukka. Is a little tiny file. I don't know why they shouldn't charge for it, but they do. It's Code Sorcery Workshop. I don't mind paying the money. They're so cool. $15. What it is a little application that'll you can put a bookmark in your webpage that will automatically post to Delicious. So what I do is if I'm on a page that I'm going to add to Delicious for this show or Twit or any of the other shows, I select the text I want to save. I press the Pukka. No, I can't say it. Pukka. Button on my browser. It works in any browser. And then this is the best part. You add the tags you want. You press the add link button and then listen what it does. I love this part. It makes a little sound. Oh, I've turned it off in this version, so it wouldn't do it because I'm Pukka-ing all the time.
Come on, let's hear it.
Oh, I know. I have to open Pukka and change the preferences.
Pukka.
Because I turned this on. Yeah. I don't know if it's worth 14. I mean, it doesn't do much. I just love it. Here, I'll redo this link so that you can. I'm linking now to the KLF manual on Pukka, and I'm a press. Ooh, duplicate URL. Keep editing like new. Okay, because I already did it once, And now I'm going to add the link, and here's the little pucka sound. This is how you know it's called pucka. Come on, make the. I love that.
Oh, I love it.
It makes me nice. Happy. I hear that, and I go, okay. I think Fripp actually did that sound.
Sitting on a stool.
Yeah. It's Fripper.
Can't enjoy the delicious. Can't figure it out. I don't know. I just don't like it.
You know, it's an acquired taste, but once you acquire it, it's hard to get it out of your mouth.
I don't like that.
It's great for searching for things that have been scanned and approved by other people. Like if you're looking for a freeware audio editor, you'll get a million bad links off of Google, but off of Delicious, you'll say, oh, wow, that one's been favorited by 2,000 people. Maybe that's
I also do it. I use it in reverse all the time. If I'm on a page, I have a bookmarklet for show me who else bookmarked this.
Oh, that's clever.
And I'll hit that and I'll just pull up everybody's comments on it.
Oh, that's a great idea. Where'd you get that bookmarklet? Is that on Delicious? That probably is in the help section. There's a lot of ways to use Delicious. I use it, of course, to bookmark stories as I'm preparing for the various shows we do. And so I have a Delicious account and I use it to bookmark it. But Pucka is the easiest way to do that. $14.95 should be free. But
you're a Cocalicious man.
I am a Cocalicious man. I use Cocalicious then look at the things. You can use Cocalicious to post. For instance, in NetNewsWire, you can have it use Cocalicious to post. But Pucka is simple. It just does what it does. I don't know.
Now I love the
spelling.
Huh? P-U-K-K-A.
P-U-K. Oh, so Pucka. I'm sorry. They're wrong. I'm right.
You don't get to
take a word that already exists and then declare that.
I agree.
Unless you're putting up a sound file changes it.
I'm not sure that they have that sort of authority at this stage in their venture capital adventure.
I don't know if they have VC for this thing, but
Pucka.
That's how you.
What happens if we put Pucka into the Urban Dictionary?
Please don't.
would I be scared?
Please don't. Aren't they doing?
I kept myself silly looking at the Urban Dictionary. It's hysterical.
They're making a book of this, like a print book.
Of
the Urban Dictionary.
It's almost like Wikipedia for obscenity. Like anytime somebody throws out some term, I always go straight to the slogan.
I like to use it for plan. Be, that word doesn't mean what you think it means.
I do not think that word means what you think it means. So like on the front page of Urban Dictionary now, bare-sterned is a verb. Barsexual, a college-age girl who kisses other girls in bars and clubs, usually for attention. That's good.
And drinks.
Don't tase me, bro. Let's see. Who is left? Alex Lindsay, Mr. Lindsay of the Pixel Core.
I have one that's zero Alex's. And it was actually suggested by someone on the Delicious tags. And so I was downloading it. And
see?
I actually enjoy it quite a bit, which is called Media Snap. Did you guys see this?
No.
So Media Snap is yet another way. And I know I'm a little obsessive, but I get frustrated with whatever the current YouTube stripper, you know, the thing that'll pull YouTube videos out. And this one is a great little UI for basically what you can do is you can say, I wanted to download Obama's speech on race. And so I just do, you know, Obama race and it searches YouTube for me and, shows all the stuff that's related to that. And then I just hit, I just want to start downloading that. And it's just great the way it's set up because I can sit there and just click, 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 click. They disappear from my playlist as soon as I click on them and move to a download list. And then I can just keep on kind of cruising along, downloading stuff. And it works really, really well.
I wish somebody would figure out, that sounds awesome. I've been using VideoBox, but it's being a little weird with 3.1 on Safari.
And MediaSnap is just super good.
I would love for somebody to go back and record how many times we've had a recommendation that was basically how to get videos off of YouTube.
Well, it is.
We had Tube Sock.
Here's the thing is, I don't want to watch them. I don't want to watch them on the computer.
I want to watch them while I'm doing
a stationary bike at the gym. You know,
does it work on Google Video too? Because I mean, the Google Video has some awesome like full length movies up.
They do, I don't know if it works on that. This one's designed completely wired up. Someone should make one for Google. So if they're listening, if the person who's doing Media Snap is listening, I think he is from Germany. You should make one for Google Video. But the one that works for YouTube works really, really well. And as I said, what I do is I'll pull a whole bunch of stuff down that I feel like I should have seen or that I want to see at some point in time. And then I like the evil eye from the little kid and, just to keep up with the stuff, you know.
Can I ask you a technical question that's slightly related, Alex?
Sure.
Will anybody ever figure out a way, do you think, to pull down Hulu videos?
I have a way to pull down Hulu videos.
Does Vixie work on Hulu? V-I-X-Y?
It's called Snaps.
Oh, he captures them.
You can just take Snap. If I want to pull
That's
something
like
down.
That's like steampunk capture. My God.
It is, but
no, steampunk capture is using your flip camera to shoot the screen.
Made out of brass and tubes.
I mean, I do the same thing with NPR is that I use a wiretap studio and I play NPR in the morning and I just hit record and then I go back to whatever I'm doing. And, I set up the playlist because you use their little flash player and you can rearrange everything and get it just the way you want it rather than the crap that they put
Hulu's
in.
Hulu's got some really good stuff up.
We watch Hulu every night.
I've been using a Windows program called Replay Media Catcher that is a really good flash video catcher. Catches the actual stream itself. There's a little bit of degradation, but I can deal with it. It makes these beautiful like VHS, beautiful like full screen Hulu videos look like a YouTube video of full length. But again, deal with it. Uh-huh. It's good.
What's it called?
It's from Appian Technologies. It's called Replay Media.
Oh yeah, that's actually really excellent. But is that Windows only though?
It is Windows only, but it's $40, and that's the reason why I have dual boot on my MacBook.
All those Appian programs are fantastic, but they're Windows only. You can capture a lot of different streams.
There's so many for taking any audio that's somewhere that you can't just simply download it, no matter what the source, no matter how it is. It's beautiful. This isn't Windows Break Weekly, but I could talk about this for 15 minutes. I love it so much.
Yeah, the problem that I have with the actual one that's hard to get stuff off of is ABC, because ABC, when their ads come up, they stop and you have to click to continue. With Hulu, you can just hit play and it'll put the ads in it, which I don't really care about. The ads actually in Hulu are actually pretty good. And
they're short and unobtrusive.
The Comfort Inn one is the Comfort Inn. The ads are actually worth watching. So
Patrick, you might want to tell Universal that Media Snap does work on the Buddy Holly video, FYI. So I'm told.
I will.
Get their bloodhounds out on that.
Try
someone off of Twitter wants me to ask you, Patrick, if you're scared of being on Cessnas after shooting that video.
Dude, I will never get in a Cessna. Hey, let me ask you guys this, though. I just got 400 emails.
Oh, turn off. Go into your Twitter settings. Those are all people adding you. Turn off email notifications. You don't want to know.
Twitter just sends you a receipt saying, hey, someone's just started. It's not the person itself. It's just Twitter saying, hey.
Patrick, on behalf of the rest of the internet, I'd like to welcome you to the world of bacon.
That's called bacon.
Bacon is like spam, bacon. But not
it's
really.
Like, you
spam,
you
but you signed
for
up
it.
For it. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Just a little program note here. I am going out of the country. I'm going to Australia for a photo expedition. More about that on my blog, leoville.com. I'm leaving Sunday. So this is the last Mac Break Weekly for a couple of, maybe 3 weeks. I'm not getting back to April 15th, so we won't do another show. Possibly we'll do it on April 16th late or April 22nd, depending on. I'm probably going to be pretty tired when I get back. I don't know what I'm going to be able to do. So not only are we going to miss the next few weeks for Mac Break Weekly, other shows will as well. We'll have a twit this Sunday, but we'll miss April 7th and 14th. Net at Night won't have another show till April 21st. Windows Weekly will come back April 17th. Jumping Monkeys will be back April 12th. We have one. Actually, we'll miss April 12th. We have a couple in the can. Munchcast, we're going to be back April 19th. So, in effect, we're going to have 2 weeks off for almost all the podcasts. The Gizwiz and Security Now will continue on. Those guys are animals. We've pre-recorded ahead for this. And we will have some Tech Guy shows, at least two, if not more, Tech Guy shows for you. But I do apologize. Think of it as spring break, minus the wet t-shirts and the fun. Just take some time off. Listen to old shows. I apologize, but they can't do them when I'm not here. And do follow my blog, because I have a lot of pictures and video and blogging, and maybe even some special podcasts from Australia. Going to some very interesting people. Details on that at leoville.com. Starting April 2nd. I can't talk about it till then. All right. Well, I'm proud to say that Patrick does now have over 100 followers on Twitter already before the show's even over. And already he's just tweeted, I am so over Mac Break Weekly and these losers. So he's really fitting in very well, I think, with the...
When do these guys pee?
I'm going to wrap this up right now. Another Mac Break is broke.